TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Global Dominance Group and 9/11. This is the second part of an hour-long talk by Dr. Peter Phillips on the forces behind the neoconservative movement that are projecting U.S. military power worldwide. This global dominance group, involving major military contractors, has become a powerful force in world military affairs and U.S. political processes. Dr. Phillips spoke at the 9/11 Education and Strategy Conference held in Chicago on June 4, 2006. His talk is based on recent research conducted at Sonoma State University. They identified 240 global dominance advocates who have been the primary promoters and beneficiaries of the so-called War on Terror before and after 9/11. Dr. Phillips is director of Project Censored at Sonoma State University. Project Censored identifies and researches news stories which have been underreported, misreported, or censored in the mainstream media. Dr. Phillips had explained the goals of the Global Dominance Group in part one of this talk.
So we see an emergence where the leadership class in the United States becomes dominated by a neoconservative group of people who have a shared goal of aggressively asserting U.S. military power worldwide. Our research identifies the key actors in this global dominance group, examines how they are interconnected, how they are supported by the corporate media, and how these key newsmakers use public relation firms to put their agendas out. And we review who benefited after 9/11, and we examine how Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld as the most public figures of this group, but how they're interlocked in public-private partnerships with the corporate media, with private foundations, the military contractors, policy elites, government officials, and that collectively, in a very tight group, they support the U.S. military global domination of the world.
Dr. Peter Phillips. In 1994, Dr. Phillips wrote his dissertation about the all-male, mostly white, bohemian club meeting of the power elite in the Redwood Forest of Northern California. He begins this part of his talk by referring to their annual meeting in June. Peter Phillips.
We're here in Chicago. As we're speaking, it is 9:10 in the morning in California. The Bohemians are having breakfast. And they're having breakfast out at the Bohemian Grove in Monte Rio on the Russian River in Sonoma County. There's probably about 2,000 to 3,000 of them there right now. And so they're there thinking about these issues. Probably will have something to do with Iran or national security or issues along. I mean, right now we're saber-rattling about Iran quite a bit. I attended the Grove in June of 1994. I heard this speech, and it was given, and this was a lakeside chat, and I took copious notes. You can't record anything there, but I took copious notes. I was doing my dissertation on them, so I actually got in and got to listen and hear the kinds of conversations that policy elites have, and it was very interesting. But they had a speaker there, and it was representative to me of the neoconservative agenda that was kind of going on and being advocated for at that time that's manifested itself, 10, 12 years later. He was a University of California political science professor. His topic was titled Violent Weakness. And he said that there's increasing violence in society that's weakened our social institutions. And just think, there's 2,000 to 3,000 guys sitting in front of this lake. There's no women allowed. And they're 99% white. And they're mostly middle-aged or older. And there's some, one out of three is somebody really important in the country. I mean, they're CEOs of major corporations. And now, I mean, Bush is a member. And, Bush Sr. is a member. They haven't let George in yet, George W., but they will probably. And so, these are some really important people. So the speaker's saying that our social institutions are being weakened, and this is caused by bisexualism, entertainment politics, multiculturalism, Afrocentrism, and a loss of family values and boundaries. And he says, to avert further deterioration, we need to recognize that elites, based on merit and skill, are important to society. And any elite that fails to define itself will fail to survive. We need boundaries and values set very clear. We need American-centered foreign policy. A president who understands foreign policy. It was Clinton bashing. There was a lot of Clinton jokes there then. He went on to conclude that we cannot, and this is a quote, we cannot allow the unqualified masses to carry out policy that elites must set values that can be translated into standards of authority. So that's that, you know, that's that philosophy. And then that gets, you know, portrayed, and it was a standing ovation. And 3,000 guys stood up and were cheering and clapping. And at the time, I don't think I had appreciated the degree to which, you know, this global dominance agenda was kind of emerging within the higher policy circles in the United States. So who benefits from this? Who are the people that are benefiting? And how does that manifest in terms of profit margins and that kind of thing? I want to mention one thing. You know, we put together this list of people and we identified all their, I had a couple of students. We worked all last summer, and a lot of this data will be in David Ray Griffin's book that'll come out in September, the U.S. post-American empire, post-9/11 American empire, which will be his new book. And we had a variation of this that was published on our website at projectcensor.org. So it puts together things like William Barr. He's on the Carlyle Group board. And you know, who else he's connected with? He's on the Heritage Foundation. He's in the Hoover Foundation. He was a PNAC person, PNAC. He's on the Council of Foreign Relations. He's an NSA person. And he was a former congressional assistant to Reagan. So you get these people in these high-level positions. It's kind of like a high school yearbook, and they're all in these different groups, you know, and you can go through it, and you can see, well, this person's only in two of them, and then this person's in eight of them. But they still all know each other. And, so that's typical. And I don't know how many of you ever heard of William Barr, but, I mean, he's one of the people that are making these policy decisions, and I just picked him for random because he was kind of in the middle group of having... Some people are in everything, literally. I mean, you look at Cheney, and you look at, well, Lynn Cheney, of course, is on the Lockheed Martin Board of Directors, and then she's very active in the AEI, American Enterprise Institute. So who profits from this global dominance policy? So we looked at that question, and we looked at the top defense contractors. I had my political sociology course. Each student took one of the defense contractors and did a full who's on their board and how much, what's their profit margin. They did these nice charts. It was really fun. And we took some of that data from that, and then we refined it a bit. And so Lockheed Martin has probably been one of the big beneficiaries from post-9/11 expansion. Their sales rose by 30% from 2000 to 2001 to 2004. And their stock value went up 300%. So it was a substantial increase. Northrop Grumman, same thing. Mass big stock increase. DoD contracts in 2001, $3.2 billion. In 2004, $11.1 billion. So quadrupling. Now Halliburton, where Cheney was former CEO, has seen phenomenal growth. Halliburton had $400 million in government contracts in 2001. 2 years later, they had $4.3 billion. So, and it's cumulative. I mean, you know, they just got the contracts to build more detention centers in the United States. So, Homeland Security huge amounts of money. And so their stock, I mean, Cheney, he had options on 400,000 shares of Halliburton stock, which at one point was really only worth less than a buck a share. After 9/11, it's now worth about $8 million. So he had this several million dollar increase in value of just the stock he had, and he still gets a couple hundred thousand a year and as a retirement benefit from Halliburton. The Carlyle Group, which we know George Sr. was in, and a number of others have been consultants and involved with that for a long time worldwide, you know, they have $30 billion in assets. They're a kind of a money management firm. and a very large number of people in the global dominance group are part of them. Carlucci, Bush, Baker, Kennard, Richard Darman. They purchased United Defense in 97, then after 2001, they sold it for $1 billion profit. So that worked real well for them. So profits for defense contractors are so good that the New York Times in May of 2005 said they got too much money. They're sitting on like $30 billion. What are they going to do with it? They really said this is a problem. Even Boeing at that time had $6.5 billion of cash. So huge amounts of cash have flown into these contractors and top corporations. So we took the top seven defense contractors that had more than a third of their income from defense contracts. So it's a vital piece of their business to be aware of what the policies are in terms of the U.S. We added in Halliburton and Carlyle because of their political connections. Take someone like GE. Their defense contracts are really only about 5% of their business. I mean, they're just a huge conglomerate, and they own NBC, and I mean, they're huge, but it's not as vital to their business overall, the defense contracts. If you look at Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, their contracts in the government are vital to the success and the continuing success of that of those corporations, which is the reason why Lockheed Martin gave to two-thirds of the people in Congress. I mean, two-thirds of the people in Congress received donations from Lockheed Martin in the last congressional election in 2004. So they're deeply involved and very interested in the political process. We list the board of directors of those corporations and the policy council groups and the people in that have been advocating for this, and that's kind of how we put that network together. Now, part of that network also includes direct connections with the corporate media in the U.S., A network analysis of the boards of directors of the top 10 media organizations shows that there's really only 118 people, they darn near fit in this room, that run the corporate media in the U.S., MSNBC, ABC. You know, if you look at their board of directors, we've got 118 individuals. They, in turn, sit on the corporate boards of 288 national and international corporations. So there's this direct interconnect between the media and the big corporations throughout the United States. When we say media today, it's corporate media. I mean, you literally mean that. They're interconnected with the biggest corporations in the U.S. But they're also, and this is relatively new, very much interconnected with this global dominance group. So William Kennard from the Carlyle Group sits on the New York Times board. He was also former FCC director. Douglas Warner III, who's on Bechtel's board, is also sits on GE and NBC's board. John Bryson from Boeing is on Disney's board, ABC. Alwyn Lewis from Halliburton is on ABC's board as well. And Douglas McCorkendale from Lockheed Martin sits on the Gannett board. So you got half of the top 10 with somebody directly from a big defense contractor sitting on the board of director of big media groups in the country. So this media interlock effectively represents corporate America's interests, and the media has responded to this. So we actually measured the numbers of sites by two of the key global dominance advocacy groups, American Enterprise Institute. The New York Times had 55 quotes in 2000 from AEI. And then after 9/11 in 2005, they had 99 quotes. So that was like an 80% increase. And the Washington Post, same thing. 87 quotes from AEI. In 2005, 157. It's like every other day, AEI gets in the Washington Post to is quoted on some issue that's going on. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, New York Times cited them 25 times in 2000, 61 times in 2005. Washington Post, 54 times in 2000, 81 times in 2005. So these global advocacy organizations are getting more sites, more coverage, and they're represented more in the corporate media in terms of their points of view. So that was interesting. I mean, that was certainly something new relative to that. And, you know, and we took a look specifically at Iran and going ahead with a war against Iran, you know, this whole idea that, you know, Iran's going to get the bomb and that there will be a, I mean, this is Bolton's quote. Iran is like 9/11 with a nuclear option. And Rice called Iran the number one terrorist state in the world. This all happened in the same week. Rumsfeld, Bush, all of them. What we found also was that in terms of LexisNexis and newspaper coverage, in 2000, Iran was mentioned 250 times in the major papers in the U.S. This year, it's been 890 times. Negative, I mean, that Iran is a danger. So we've seen a significant increase since 9/11 in terms of coverage of identifying Iran. And the PNAC was saying Iran's the bad guys, 10 years ago. So they're continuing with that agenda. But they have help. And their help is public relation firms. This was remarkable to us because I didn't really know this until about a year and a half ago. Public relations industry, since 9/11, has seen phenomenal growth and massive mergers, massive consolidation. So there's three large publicly traded mega corporations now, Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Trust. These firms employ 163,000 people over 170 countries, and they are a network of they control a massive amount of wealth. They're interconnected with the most powerful institutions in the United States, corporate and government. And they have direct connections within the global dominance group, the multinational corporations, and the policymaking groups. So, like WPP is a UK-based conglomerate, and they make up Young and Rubicon, Burston Marsellers, Ogilvy and Mather Worldwide, Helen Knowlton. Remember the incubator babies in the first Gulf War? Well, that was a Helen Knowlton story. And with a number of other PR, advertising, and crisis management firms all over the world. So this control of media, control of the ideas that are being presented, are going through these massive firms. There's a number of independents, but they're clearly, keyly interlocked. WPP groups, they have four of their members on the Council of Foreign Relations. Omnicom has a position on Time Warner. And Omnicom has somebody on a lifetime member of the PBS board. So they're closely interlocked. And this is management of information and news. So and then there's a number of notable, and some like the Lincoln Group, which we've heard about. But you don't hear a lot about the Rendon Group, unless you follow war news. I mean, well, they don't like say that they're making the war news, but they do. Rendon Group is the company that has worked since the 80s, managing the images of Americans' imperial wars. They worked for Bush. They handled Serbia. The first big one was the invasion of Panama. And so they shaped the international support for the first Gulf War. They actually created the Iraqi National Congress and handpicked Ahmad Shalabi to be the head of that. I mean, they got CIA money to do that. So the Rendon Group is one that manipulates the news. So they're the ones that brought us the pulling down of the statue. I mean, they took the Iraqi National Congress guys, brought them into that square, right in front of the Palestine Hotel where the media all was after they'd shot a few of them, and get the tank to pull down the statue, and that becomes a symbolism, and there's people cheering and stuff, which were from the Iraqi Congress that were brought in. It wasn't local people. And that become this image, this of how the war was going and we were winning and how happy the Iraqi people were that we were there and all of this. And that was the Rendon Group doing that. They also did the Jessica Lynch story. So, Jessica Lynch, the heroic rescue, they've got the camera crews following the special forces in to rescue her in the hospital. And that was timed. I mean, that was the day that the tanks were rolling into Baghdad. That's the day we shot the artillery shells in the Palestine Hotel. That's the day we bombed Al Jazeera. And what's on the front page all over the country? Jessica Lynch. That was deliberate. That was the Rendon Group. That was their policies of deception and having stories that lock us out. So the levels of this, the Lincoln Group now we know had a $100 million contract. They were paying writers in Iraq to write stories favorable to the military. That came out. They were new. I mean, they were formed less than 3 years ago. And part of their group was this Vincent Beligo, who was a pollster for Reagan and Bush administrations, a PNAC member, Devon Cross, Douglas Dirth, who was a former Joint Military Intelligence Training Center. So these global dominance people, and you know, they'll form a PR company, get a $100 million contract, make money off of this stuff, and they're the ones helping create the lies and the stories that are the propaganda. And then we can get a sense of the money involved here. I mean, the Clinton administration in 2000 spent $38 million on 64 contracts with public relations firms. And you go, oh, wow, that's a lot. You know, I mean, that's creating the news and stuff. Bush, this is from the GOA report, in 30 months from 2003-04 and half of 2005, spent $1.5 billion on public relations firms and media. So you see the massive increase, and that's part of what's feeding this consolidation of PR firms in the world, and creating the news literally that we're come to cover or not cover. Another piece of this, which I think is very important, is that, you know, in order to stay in power, they had to win the 2004 election, and it was pretty close. And the polls were, you know, had them neck and neck, you know, and. And of course, the media went along. There was no major issues. I mean, Kerry wanted to put more troops in Iraq, and there was a difference in terms of Social Security, maybe. This is maybe why 80 million people didn't bother to vote. Maybe Social Security, maybe abortion were issues that bothered people. But for the most part, there weren't key differences. But they were still pretty worried. Now, we all know that Gore won Florida in 2000. I mean, Carter actually came out last fall and admitted that. And they finished that 8-month study in the fall of 2001, where they reviewed 175,000 Florida ballots, not counted in the 2000 election, and analysis by the National Opinion Research Center confirmed Gore actually won. Well, that news came out after 9/11, about a week later. So, of course, nobody heard it. And the 2004 election was just as fraudulent. The official vote count showed that Bush won by 3 million votes. And the exit polls showed Kerry winning by 5 million votes. And most people say, well, exit polls, you know, surveys, how accurate is that? And there's always errors and stuff like that. But in this case, the Edison Media Research and Mitofsky International were the two firms hired to do the polling. It was 13,000 people were polled, which, you know, your normal Gallup poll is about anywhere from 1,200 to 2,000. And that gets you within a 3% plus or minus accuracy rate of the opinions on an issue for the entire population. And unless you ask a question that people don't understand, or, you know, you have a leading question, you want to bring it one way or the other, then, you know, the math is right. I mean, you can, but it's pretty difficult to go wrong when somebody's walking out of a poll and saying, who did you vote for president for 5 minutes ago? I mean, most people get that right. And you know, and so you got 13,000, so that takes you up to the 99.5% accuracy level in the country if you randomly select people in the polls. So this 8 million vote, the chances of statistically the polls being wrong in the country is about 100,000 to one. That's just the math. But it's interesting because in California and 37 other states, the exit polls match the voter results. They were, you know, they came out the same. I mean, the exit polls in California matched what the Secretary of State said the election was. You go, oh, good. 13 states, were major differences, some of which Kerry won, but it would have won by much larger margins. You know, Bush needed that, you know, public mandate for continuing the global dominance agenda, essentially. These 13 states, I have a list of them here. Colorado, Florida, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nevada, New Mexico, and Ohio. We often just talk about Ohio. That's where the exit polls didn't match the results. And that's where the 8 million votes are concentrated. Now, statistical possibility of that only happening in those states gets you up into the millions to one. Well, 2004 was fraudulent. I mean, there's just no question about it. And Carter and Baker, they had their commission a year ago. They did a report, said, you know, yeah, there were problems. The lines were too long, you know, in some states. And, you know, you had to wait 12 hours if you lived in a black neighborhood in Ohio to get to vote and that kind of thing. And it was raining. And, but, you know, it was, and Florida had election, registration problems against it like that. But it was a fair election, and the differences didn't make that much matter. The Democrats don't want to bring this out either. They don't want a populist revolt demanding freedom of information, demanding electoral reform, demanding getting the corporations out of the political process. They don't want that. So they're not going to bring forward information. I mean, why this hasn't come forward as a major story, it beats me. But, I mean, it was one of our top five stories last year. Books have come out about it. Dennis Liu from Cal Poly Pomona wrote a whole chapter in our book about all this is documented. Got new books coming out of it. Seven Stories Press is bringing a book out on election fraud. It's quite odd. Everybody knows. But it's just not in the front pages of everybody's paper, and it's easy to dismiss as, oh, well, that's just, flaws in the review process or something.
That was Dr. Peter Phillips. He co-authored this talk on the Global Dominance Group with Bridget Thornton and Celeste Vogler. The research originated at Project Censored at Sonoma State University in California. You can find the text of the document at their website, projectcensored.org. That's projectcensored.org. Each year, Project Censored publishes a compilation of the most important stories that were censored from the mainstream media. The authors of this paper believe that knowing the general parameters of the Global Dominance Group will provide an understanding of who had means, opportunity, and motive to have initiated a post-9/11 acceleration of neoconservative military expansion towards the goal of assuming full-spectrum military dominance of the world. Understanding the parameters of the Global Dominance Group will also allow researchers to explore the possibilities of insider pre-knowledge of the 9/11 attacks. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for a link to Project Censored. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order a CD or audio tape of this one-hour talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your order of a copy of this program is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE. TUC tape translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gallardon. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.